Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
People who know what they're talking about say, hey, you want to figure out where the economy's going? Forget stocks, forget corporate profits. Look, they say, at the bond market. So that's what we're going to do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information available at newsstands every Saturday. And by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 26th of October today. And hey, here's an interesting investment idea. Pay the government to hold your money. For the first time yesterday, the Treasury Department sold inflation-protected bonds at what's called a negative yield. Buyers lined up to lend the government money and then paid for the privilege. The bond market matters because it can help you figure out the future direction of all kinds of things. Economic growth, interest rates, consumer prices, the whole shebang. And so the success of this week's Treasury auction is kind of a bet that the Federal Reserve's latest plan to juice the economy and drive up inflation just might work. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Let's say I invest in a government bond, which is really the same as lending the government money. The bond is worth $100. But instead of getting paid interest by the government, I'm actually going to pay a little extra, 55 cents, meaning I start out at a loss.
It's rational, but it appears to be nuts.
University of Portland finance professor Rich Gritta says it's rational because this particular bond offers a guaranteed protection against inflation. Dan Greenhouse at institutional trading firm Miller Tabak explains, if inflation goes up, the value of the bond goes up too.
Even if you overpaid in the immediate, a sufficient enough rise in prices will compensate you for whatever overpayment you had in the short term.
And Greenhouse says the fact that investors snapped up these inflation-protected bonds means they're betting prices will rise eventually, which in turn means they believe the Federal Reserve will succeed in reversing the stagnation in consumer prices we've seen in the recession. And why would the Fed want higher prices? Well, because low prices are keeping the economy down, says Rich Gritta.
Deflation sounds cool because, hey, widescreen TV sets are real cheap. But the bad news is that producers can't make money, so they quit producing. And then what you get's a continuing recession.
To make sure that doesn't happen, the Fed is expected to pump hundreds of billions of dollars into the economy and bet that prices will rise, which in turn will give businesses a chance to make more money on what they make and sell and what they export abroad. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was some good news today from the Motor City. Ford Motor Company said it earned $1.7 billion in the third quarter, its sixth profitable quarter in a row. It's been cutting costs, and it's going to pay down more of its debt. But Ford is doing something more interesting, too, building cars and trucks that drivers actually want to buy. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains exactly how Ford is kicking its turnaround plan into overdrive.
The U.S. economy may still be struggling to recover, but Ford's stellar results are largely because it's doing so well at home. Operating profit for the division was five times higher than in the third quarter last year. And that's important because Ford depends more on U.S. sales than its rivals GM and Chrysler do. Kirk Ludke follows the auto industry at CRT Capital Group.
I would say volume and mix in North America was really the biggest driver of the year-over-year improvement, followed closely by pricing.
Ford is selling more cars here because it's been introducing a range of new products, from little fuel-efficient jobs like the Fiesta, which was brought over from Europe, to big, heavy-duty pickup trucks. They're vehicles that people really want to drive and that they're willing to pay top dollar for. Dave Whiston is an auto industry analyst at Morningstar.
When you have a full line of model segments that customers are willing to pay up for, you can make a lot of money even in a pretty depressed sales environment that we have now in the U.S. auto industry.
He says that means the company should be in great shape when the auto market really comes back. Ford is already planning for the future. It says it's paying off a big chunk of debt early. And after years of cutting costs, it's investing $850 million in Michigan over the next 2 years to hire 1,200 workers and build more fuel-efficient cars. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Staying with transportation here for just a bit, next time you book a flight with one of the big airlines, say Delta or United, be sure you read the fine print, because your flight might actually wind up being contracted out to a regional carrier you have never heard of, a regional carrier that may not have the same safety standards as the big guys do. The National Transportation Safety Board spent some time going over those contracts today, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
This is how these contracts work. So I'm booking a flight from Newark to Buffalo here. The flight says Continental, but it's operated by Colgan Air. Bill McGee, a Consumers Union travel consultant, says one out of two domestic flights is operated by a regional carrier like Colgan.
Now, the real concern is that consumers are not aware of this.
Regional carriers generally pay pilots less and have worse safety records than major airlines. The crash of a Colgan flight last year is one reason the National Transportation Safety Board is looking at these carriers and possible safety measures like longer breaks for pilots. Richard Gritta, a professor of finance and transportation, says consumers will notice changes one way or another.
Anytime you say, well, we're going to schedule longer breaks, then, of course, the cost of flying goes up, and then, of course, the price goes up.
Still looking for a cheap and safe flight to Buffalo. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The most actively traded shares today on the New York Stock Exchange? Citigroup, Bank of America, and Ford in that order. Just thought you might like to know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Remember all those stories you heard about the home buyer tax credit and how when it went away, the housing market would get a serious case of the blahs? Well, welcome to today's Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Home Price Index. The August numbers came out this morning. Prices were down for the second month in a row. You throw in the botched foreclosure paperwork still gumming up tens of thousands of bad mortgages, and you've got a housing market firmly stuck in the mud. The Obama administration has rolled out a bunch of mortgage and foreclosure modification programs without too much success. Nothing lately, though, as political Washington has been sidelined by the election. But once the votes are counted, might something happen on housing? Marketplace's John Dimsdale looked into it.
The nation's housing mess is keeping courts busy. State investigators are sending mortgage lenders subpoenas. Homeowners are filing class action lawsuits. At a housing conference yesterday, FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair said she's worried about the growing foreclosure mess.
I fear that the litigation generated by this issue could ultimately be very damaging to our housing markets if it ends up prolonging those foreclosures that are necessary and justified.
Instead, Bair suggested a deal where regulators could shield lenders from lawsuits in return for reducing interest rates and/or principal on troubled mortgages. Another possible government solution includes more tax credits for homebuyers, but after the midterm elections, Congress isn't likely to bite.
Coming up with ideas where they can do something without increasing the deficit is probably the only thing that's going to fly at this point.
That's KBW mortgage finance analyst Bose George. He suggests using Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to offer investors in foreclosed properties a cheaper loan,
which gets paid back over time with interest, so there's no outlay on the part of the government in terms of funds.
Another idea from former mortgage banker Clifford Rossi: set up a new type of mortgage where the lender and borrower share in the home's equity, but the lender also shares in any losses if the home's value drops.
So they could take a 40% share of the loss, a 40% share of the upside appreciation.
He says regulators could endorse these deals, which wouldn't cost taxpayers another dime. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
According to the Department of Labor, there are, give or take, 155 million people in the American workforce. That number is going to grow because people tend to make more people. Kids who are going to grow up and in 20 years or so have to figure out how to compete in a global economy that's probably not going to look a whole lot like the one we have now. The job market has our attention this week. Today, what the present might mean for workers of the next generation. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
That's how baby Maxwell reacts when you take his dad's cell phone away from him. He likes holding it and putting it in his mouth. But he's not just a gadget guy. Maxwell likes books. He puts those in his mouth, too.
You know, I have no idea what he's going to be like. I mean, ideally, I would love for him to be some type of human rights advocate or an engineer.
Yeah, I wonder which pays more. Mom, Virginia Kim, and Dad, Chris Berciago, are raising Maxwell in Orange County, California. She's a public school teacher. He works for a translation services company. They lead a comfortable middle-class life. But they've read the studies. They know a college degree is now the minimum Maxwell will need to stay in the middle class, let alone rise higher.
Yeah, there's an Orange County school that's nearby us that there are people, they kind of fudge their address so they can go to these particular schools over here because it looks good going into college.
I've already looked into his kindergarten. Yeah.
But aside from a good education, Virginia and Chris, like many parents, wish they knew the magic formula that would guarantee Maxwell's future prosperity.
I just want to say one word to you. Plastics.
You can't think about the future of jobs without thinking of the line from the movie The Graduate.
Futurist Paul Saffo gets paid to forecast long-term trends for investors of San Francisco-based Discern Analytics. He says if that late 60s movie were made today, he might whisper biology into Dustin Hoffman's ear. Saffo's a big believer in the future of biotechnology, a big umbrella sort of industry that promises everything from faster-growing fish to a cure for cancer.
So the first question is, what are the jobs that spin out of the biology revolution?
What do you see?
Not possible? Labor economists will tell you their efforts to predict jobs 20, even 10 years out often prove fruitless. But Saffo is convinced of one thing. Maxwell's job market will be even more competitive than today.
This is becoming a borderless global workplace. Children born today will spend part of their lives abroad if they are successful professionals in the same way their parents moved to different states.
Maybe the most important question, Saffo says, is what kind of skills Maxwell and his classmates will need to succeed. Saffo weighed in along with some other job experts.
Analytic and quantitative skills.
Social awareness, social IQ, as I call it.
Creative problem solving.
The ability to be adaptable.
Language skills, foreign languages.
And then, of course, communication skills.
Sounds like baby Maxwell has his work cut out for him. But our experts are convinced they'll all be needed in what they predict will be an even more globalized, digitized, technology-driven economy. Marina Gorbis is president of the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, California. She envisions a world where computers, robots, and other sophisticated machines have overtaken many of the middle-class jobs that involved routine work.
In the next 10 to 20 years, we see these very smart, quote-unquote, machines entering every domain of our lives. We're going to be interacting with them on a massive scale.
If you're skeptical of a Jetsons-like future, Gorbis says, just ask teaching assistants in South Korea. They're already being replaced by robots that can recite stories and lead routine math drills. Now, that doesn't mean all teachers will disappear, but Gorbis says well-paid work will demand more skills than it does today, and it will be the sort of creative work that machines can't do.
Everything that cannot be defined, that's novel, improvisational, where you need to quickly adapt on the spot, anything related to kind of abstract, high-level thinking.
That's why Gorbis says emphasize creative problem-solving. Schools can teach it. It's usually done in group exercises. They can take a lot of class time, but Gorbis says creative problem-solving is a key to innovation and a necessary skill in a lot of the new jobs created by all those smart machines destroying some old jobs.
My name is Michael Mills. I'm a senior user experience designer at Schematic in Los Angeles.
That's user experience designer, sort of like architecture, but for digital information, Mills says. It's the kind of job we'll see more of in the future as consumers demand more complex technology that's really easy to use.
So the simplest way that I explain it to people is think of anything that has a screen on it. And I try and figure out what needs to be on there and how it needs to work.
In college, he majored in math and art, so he's got the creative and the problem-solving down pat. A high degree of empathy is called for, too. Add that to Maxwell's 21st century skill set. Jonas Priesing, the president of Manpower's Americas division, is pushing today's parents to think about an even less quantifiable skill.
The very rapid change means that it's going to be hard to be proficient at a skill that will take you through 40 years of workforce career. So your ability to be adaptable is going to be extremely important.
This is all pretty heavy lifting in a country where the public schools are struggling. Kids rank 21st internationally in math and 25th in science. Priesing says mastering those basic skills, not to mention things like creativity and adaptability, is the most daunting task ahead.
This will be one of the most strategic and important challenges for our nation to resolve, because it is really the key to our future prosperity as a nation, and of course those of our children and our children's children.
Maybe it's a good thing baby Maxwell is oblivious to the challenging future ahead of him. Besides, he's busy mastering more primary skills right now. His mom reports that he just learned to clap and crawl. In Orange County, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the series, how some companies are rethinking the very definition of job to make room for more people. For now, though, check your industry's prospects with our Future Jobs-O-Matic, the fastest growing, fastest shrinking, highest paying and lowest paying jobs of the future. It's all online, marketplace.org. Coming up, all right, so it's the 12th largest state, but home to the most expensive house race in the country.
This is a race that's probably going to total $16 to $18 million, which is, you know, roughly 9 or 10 times what we see on average.
You give up? It's in Minnesota. But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks couldn't decide whether they were coming or going today, so they pretty much stood still. The Dow Industrials ticked up just 5 points, less than a 10%. Closed at 11,169. The NASDAQ up 6 points, about a 0.25%, 2,497. At the bell, the S&P 500 didn't really budge. Ended the day where it started at 1,185. Financials weren't too exciting. Bank of America added 1.25%. Goldman Sachs put on 0.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 0.33% gain. Citigroup gave back more than 0.67% today. Weak earnings dragged down steel stocks on this Tuesday. ArcelorMittal sheared off more than 5%. AK Steel reversed nearly 4%. Today, U.S. Steel unloaded 3.33%. On the upside, Ford revved up nearly 1.5%, as we mentioned on those strong profits that we told you about earlier. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.64%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for September. President Obama is scheduled to make an appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And in San Francisco, the World Series begins with the Giants and the Rangers. Play ball! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The closer elections get, the less you can get away from them, mostly in a horse race sense, who's ahead, who's behind, where the polls are. And in a way, that makes sense, because actual elections, not the campaigns, but the elections, are about counting votes. So today we continue our series about the people behind the machinery of politics. Commentator and pollster Scott Rasmussen talks about crunching the numbers.
Being a pollster in the final weeks of an election season, it's a bit crazy. Every night, loads of new data comes in from around the country that needs to be processed, reviewed, reported, and put into context. Each new poll release brings forth a torrent of comments. Those who like the results tout our brilliance, and those who don't complain that some other poll is better. We answer hundreds of press inquiries during the closing days of the season, and if we tell a reporter the race is too close to call, well, some still insist on knowing who's going to win. We patiently explain that if we knew, we wouldn't be calling that race a toss-up. Other comments come from the losing candidates and their campaigns, and they just don't want to believe the numbers. In this frenzy, my focus is always on the data. We believe in our numbers because we believe in the system that we've built. The greatest danger for pollsters is to overstate what the numbers really say. Discipline is key because advocates try to sway what we say about the numbers. This craziness, of course, culminates on election night, which is a long night for our entire staff as we root for our poll results. If we show a Republican ahead in one race by two and a Democrat in another by three, well, we root for the Republican by two in the first race and the Democrat by three in the other. After the election, the data flow subsides a bit, and so do the questions. During this briefest of downtimes, I make it a point to get away for a trip with my wife because she hasn't received the attention she deserves. But then the real work begins. We do our most important work as pollsters after the election. We look at the results we projected, we compare them to what really happened, and we learn from both what we did right and wrong. We establish the protocols and procedures that will guide us during the next season. These lessons build the foundation so we can have confidence in the numbers for the next pre-election frenzy.
Scott Rasmussen is the co-author of the book Mad as Hell, How the Tea Party Movement is Fundamentally Remaking Our Two-Party System. Tomorrow in our series, our regular David Frum. In the meanwhile, we'd love to hear from you about this upcoming election or anything else you'd care to talk to us about. Send us your comments online as best, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Those votes that Scott Rasmussen counts are getting more expensive. Estimates are that spending this cycle is going to hit $2 billion. And there are some high-profile Senate and gubernatorial campaigns helping to boost the average. But one House race in particular stands out. The incumbent, Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann in Minnesota, and her Democratic challenger, Terrell Clark, are running the costliest House race in the country. Bachmann is something of a celebrity among conservatives. She's the founder of the House Tea Party Caucus. Democrats are spending millions of dollars to try to bring her down, but the cash that Bachmann has on hand does give her plenty of options. From Minnesota Public Radio, Annie Baxter reports.
Minnesota boasts a lot of big attractions. It's home to 10,000 lakes, the Mall of America, and now a giant mountain of cash piled up in its 6th congressional district. GOP Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann has raised $11 million in her reelection bid. Her Democratic opponent, Terrell Clark, has pulled in about $4 million so far. House races usually don't see so many dollar signs unless a wealthy candidate is spending personal cash. And the fundraising isn't over yet.
This is a race that's probably going to total something in the neighborhood of $16 to $18 million, which is roughly 9 or 10 times what we see on average in a House district race across the country.
That's Stephen Smith. He's a congressional expert at Washington University in St. Louis, but he actually lives in Minnesota's 6th district. He says one reason the race has become so expensive is Bachmann's growing celebrity as a mini Sarah Palin. Smith says Bachmann is successfully using the internet and social networking to tap into grassroots donors contributing $200 or less. Terrell Clark is also drawing small contributions from Democrats who want to sink Bachmann. One of the effects of all those little donations is this.
Michelle Bachmann, standing up for BP, not us.
Terrell Clark loves taxes.
So far, Bachmann's campaign has outspent Clark more than 2-1 on ads and everything else, including polling and voter lists. Stephen Smith says those lists allow her campaign to target voters more effectively with direct mailings and telemarketing.
They don't try to organize, get out the vote drives on a block-by-block basis the way you're used to in a congressional contest, where legwork is a substitute for funding.
Though the district leans Republican and Bachman is favored to win, Smith expects Bachman will keep her checkbook open this week. But Larry Noble, former general counsel of the Federal Election Commission, doubts Bachman is going to spend all her money. He says if she wins, she'll have plenty of cash left over to launch her next re-election bid. That's a major advantage.
And that's very important in these races because it tends to keep people out on the other side. And anybody looking to challenge her will have to deal with the fact that she's going to come in with a lot of money.
Bachman can use that leftover money on a bid for even higher office, or dole it out piecemeal in contributions to GOP campaigns. But it's less clear whether she'll have enough clout to wave her fundraising wand and make her own supporters donate to fellow Republicans. Noble says that's hard to do if your donations are tied to personality.
So it'll be interesting. That's one of the real questions.
One more effect of Bachman's cash? It's forcing her opponent, Terrell Clark, to spend just about every last dime she's raised. If Clark loses this race, that'll leave her starting from scratch if she chooses to run again. In Minnesota's 6th District, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in observance of the start of the National Basketball Association season this evening, NBA uberstar LeBron James takes the court for the Miami Heat against the Celtics in Boston tonight. James's hometown of Cleveland is trying to move past his high-profile defection to the Heat this summer, and at least locals aren't going to have to be reminded of him on a daily basis. The building-sized mural of James that used to hang across from the arena that the Cavaliers play in Cleveland has been replaced by an ad for Sherwin-Williams, the paint company. It's a shot of the Cleveland skyline with the tagline, "Our home since 1866, our pride forever, and good riddance." No, it doesn't say that last part, just the pride part. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow ticked up just 5 points, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ added 6 points, about 0.25%. The S&P 500 barely budged, ended the day right where it started. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Sonata Lee on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you ought to tune tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this radio broadcast, less work for one, more work for all.
Work time reduction is an obvious way to go forward, which would allow us to share the work that we have.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.